This is FinTech Takes, the podcast keeping you in the loop on all the latest FinTech trends, news, and ideas. I'm Alex Johnson, creator of the FinTech Takes newsletter, your host and self-confessed FinTech nerd. Let's go. Hello, and welcome back to everyone's favorite not FinTech investment advice podcast, not FinTech investment advice. My name is Alex Johnson, and as per usual, I am joined by the inestimable, the exhausted, the illuminating Simon Taylor, author of FinTech Brain Food. Simon, good to see you. Before we get started today, I wanted to tell you about another FinTech podcast that I'm a huge fan of, FinTech One-on-One, hosted by Peter Renton. If you don't know Peter, he's a true OG in the FinTech space. He created FinTech Nexus, formerly Lendit, one of the premier events and media companies in our space, and he's been a consistently great interviewer of executives and experts in fintech and lending on his podcast since 2013. Let me say that again, 2013. Peter's been doing this for a long time. He's just as curious as I am about all things fintech, but he's much smarter than me and has a delightful Australian accent. So be sure to check out the FinTech One-on-One podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Good to see you, my friend. Yeah, I am pretty exhausted, but I have got my fill of fintech. FinTech meetup was incredible.
Yes.
And I'm only illuminating because I was in Vegas, which frankly has enough lights for everybody.
Right.
That was awesome, guys. Great show. Well done to the FinTech meetup folks. Alex, how are you, my friend? Good to see you.
I'm doing well. I'm sorry that I missed you in person in Vegas. My son had a lovely 6th birthday, though, so the trade was absolutely worth it. But I heard exactly the same report that you just gave. A wonderful time was had by folks in Vegas. Lots of learning, lots of exposure to unnatural light sources that made everyone kind of kept glowing as they're coming back. You're just glowing through the screen right now. So I figured it would be a good time to catch you. Yeah.
Do you know what it was, though, as well? It feels like FinTech's energy is back. Like,
yes.
People are problem solving again. Maybe we're past the, like, oh, look, another consent order. Oh, look, everything's gone wrong phase into the what do we do now? What happens after the consent orders? What happens after the drama? What happens after the prices go down and they start coming back up? We've still got to build an industry here. And that was kind of the focus. Like, how do we actually do this? And I've never in 20 years in financial services seen bankers so open and so welcoming of fintech partnerships. Now, some of that is because the tickets are free for bankers if you agree to take a meeting. That's probably fair. But also just the attitude. And so I think there's a lot of learning going on at all sides. There's a long way to go, but it was a really fun show.
That is fantastic. Well, I'm very glad, again, as you said, congrats to the organizers. You guys do a great job. And I can't wait to hopefully come back next year. I will wait with bated breath to see what the dates are for next year's show. But until then, Simon, I thought you might have one or two fintech companies that you might want to discuss. Is that true?
It's very true, my friend. Would you like me to go first?
I would love you to go first. Thank you.
All right. The first one is called chip.ai. That's chipp.ai. And as you gathered, it's a company that does a thing with AI. They call themselves Shopify for AI. Now, the idea kind of goes, let's say you're an educator or you're a legal assistant or a personal trainer, and you've got a bunch of prompts that you're using on a day-to-day basis, and you have a little training course and you're teaching people how to use prompts and how to get better at them. You're going to have a whole bunch of costs for people using your prompt. Maybe you built yourself a little website with Gen AI behind the scenes and it's helping coach people, but in your specific style. That's all going to cost you money as you're using the API calls to go back to, whether it's OpenAI or Claude or whoever you're using behind the scenes. So the idea here is you can build products or agents that can be embedded in, you know, Substack, WordPress, or Notion. But you can build a very simple pricing model for them. You can accept payments. That's where the fintech comes in. And once you've accepted those payments, you've built a little business out of something you had to do anyway. So it made me think, like, every freelancer could be sort of building their prompts around what it is that makes them them. And they could be building little agent versions of themselves, you know, like how ChatGPT has built the new agents capability, right? So that could help with everything from coaching to students to managing basic legal tasks. And I wondered, like, if Shopify helped everyone sell online, could Chip help every freelancer productize themselves? I don't know. Like, it's interesting. What are your thoughts?
Well, I love this one. So the thing that occurs to me on this one is that this seems like AI solving for an issue that I've seen crop up a lot recently, which is the value of freelance, relatively high leverage work seems to have never been higher, right? And so if you think about sort of the extension of the classic gig economy model, you know, Uber and the like, the problem that those services run into really fast actually is, okay, we've aggregated demand. People love our, you know, service that we're delivering, but shit, we're running out of drivers. We have to go recruit more drivers. We have to retain more drivers. So there's this sort of like retention scale leverage problem on the supply side of a lot of these marketplaces. And it's not just Uber and driving cars or food delivery. It's, you know, legal services. It's financial coaching. It's accounting. It's tax. It's all of these services where we've built these really great sort of, to use Ben Thompson language, aggregator front ends that can aggregate demand and create a really great sort of experience on the front end. But on the back end, it's this really sort of messy marketplace where they're trying to aggregate as much supply as possible. But, you know, if you're a freelance professional of whatever kind, consultant, accountant, lawyer, coach, whatever it is, it kind of puts you in a tough position in the same way that like Uber drivers, it's like, oh, great, I have the flexibility to drive whenever I want. But I also have to sort of drive across three platforms 24 hours a day if I really want to make any money. So there's this weird sort of like outcome, I think, of these platforms sort of democratizing access to freelance experts, where the freelance experts kind of get put under strain and don't necessarily make as much money or can't optimize their earnings as much as they might want. And so this would seem to me, to your point about training an AI agent version of yourself, a way to get more leverage on your very distinct and human set of skills that we've now built this great demand aggregation set of services to then share with the market. Does that make sense as a concept?
No, it does. It completely does. What you're saying is the human got commoditized by the aggregation.
Yes.
And so it became a price kind of competition as a freelancer, whereas actually this could invert that and make it a quality conversation. And I mean, you definitely see this. I know I do. The demand, if you have a little bit of audience, is unlimited.
Oh, yeah.
The supply is very, very limited. And I think there's only one of me.
Yep.
There's only one Alex Johnson. I nearly broke into a soccer chant then. There's only one Alex Johnson. That's the delirious tiredness.
There you go.
Again.
There you go.
But you know, the skill gap missing is still getting good at prompting and building your own agent.
Yes.
And having a Shopify-like platform that helps you build those agents, that moves you a little bit closer, that can manage some of the payments, that really could be something. And then, you know, that's where the link to fintech is. It's like Shopify really is a fintech. It's the classic meme of fintech of like, you know, something like 60, 70% of their revenue comes from financial services, but only because they solve this giant other set of problems first, like building and running and operating an online store, managing your payroll, everything else. And that's the canonical embedded finance conversation. Embedded AI is that but for freelancers. It's that but for skill work. It's that but for human work. It's that but for the thing that cannot be commoditized. Interesting hypothesis to keep playing with. And that's why I love this show, because it forces you to look at companies that expand your horizons. What are your thoughts?
Well, I couldn't agree more with that. And you just teed me up perfectly in multiple ways for me to give you my first company. Can I share?
Oh, go right ahead.
Okay, so remarkably close in a lot of ways, but also kind of different. And you mentioned sort of trying to expand your horizons. I've been trying to wrap my head around this company. In fact, by the time folks listen to this, I will have written about them a little bit in my newsletter. But the company's name is WHOP, W-H-O-P. So like, I guess shop, but WHOP instead. And they are essentially a Shopify-like marketplace connecting buyers and sellers together, but for the, I guess what I would call the internet economy, okay?
Yeah,
and so,
I've seen this.
Yeah, and I'm fascinated by them. And actually, the reason they fascinate me so much is that a piece you wrote in your newsletter a little while ago was talking about like what the next great consumer-facing companies are going to look like, right? And one of the points that you made in that piece was that it's difficult a lot of times to predict what those are going to look like because of just generational differences and generational preferences. And it's really, really hard for prior generations to fully understand what this next generation of consumers are going to want or how they think or what they're looking for. And when I look at WHOP, that's exactly the experience I have as a millennial who is like a 79-year-old millennial in like my heart of hearts. Like I'm an old soul, Simon. And so when I look at WHOP, I come away a little confused, to be totally honest, on a personal level, because very similar to what you just described, Shopify-like marketplace with embedded payments, you can sort of squint at them and see like a role that they could play in identity and other things. But the value proposition is connecting buyers to influencers that are selling access to entrepreneurial opportunities on the internet. And so I'll give you some examples. They have a marketplace for learning how to day trade or trade crypto. They have a marketplace for getting access to communities that will give you help placing sports wagers or sports betting. They have another one that is available to you to help you develop your own influencing skills and dominate TikTok or become an influencer in whatever fashion you might want to. So they have all of these sort of internet native economies where people have built up skills helping people figure out how to make money on the internet. And the difference is that unlike, you know, where these people might otherwise monetize that knowledge, like TikTok or YouTube or Twitter or Patreon, you know, name your sort of creator, influencer platform, the distinction here is that none of those platforms were really well set up from a commerce perspective. And so it's always been very hard for influencers to sort of monetize, not their influence, right? Like TikTok is really great about, hey, you know, I'm trying to hawk this particular product, you should buy it. They know how to do that, but they don't know how to monetize that influencer's ability to like pass their skills or knowledge on to other people who want to be like them. And so this is essentially a Shopify-like marketplace to enable that type of commerce. And again, I personally think this is bizarre. But anything you look at from a metrics perspective in terms of their growth, they raised, I think, a $17 million Series A last year. The velocity at which they ship products is really, really impressive. They've hired a really great team, although it's still relatively small. Everything about them screams company that's growing really quickly and is going to be one that we'll be discussing more in the future. And yet at the same time, I find them as a millennial to be completely and utterly incomprehensible. What's your take on that?
Exactly the same.
Okay.
I feel two things at once. Confused by it, and also I don't know whether to love it or hate it.
Yeah.
And I'm 50-50. On the hate side, there's a real risk here that some of these communities are just Ponzi schemes operating on a platform.
Yes.
Come subscribe to my crypto trading course. All right, but who are you?
Right.
And how good is that advice?
Totally.
And
well, you should see some of the more niche communities on there are they're very Ponzi scheme-ish sounding. They're like, transform your life with these three steps to see the truth and hack reality. And like, I mean, they're like way out there. And those are like the more kind of like on the edges ones.
Esoteric.
But yeah, still, like it's a concern.
So Ponzi as a service, not a big fan. Opposite side, I think there's a real space for curated, paid for membership clubs that are digital native.
Yeah.
I think there's a real space for finding the type of knowledge that you feel is missing for your life. And I think that should be something that's paid for.
Yep.
I think there's a real issue that monetizing knowledge is incredibly difficult unless you are one of the tippy top 0.1% of creators. And there's a middle class of creators missing. There's a middle class of, frankly, operators who have their own community. I've been reading a lot by Canali.app, AO, lately. Yeah. You know, he's an incredible writer.
Yeah, it's infuriating.
Infuriatingly good. I would love to tip that guy. I'd love to send him $10.
Totally.
I'd love to whatever. I would join his community. I just want to learn from the guy. And there are so many others like that for whom it is well and truly worth it. But I don't necessarily want to subscribe to the Substack indefinitely,
right,
or they haven't turned that on,
right,
or you know, they would feel an expectation if that was the case. So there needs to be this other space. There needs to be this discovery marketplace. So this has value, but curation matters. The risk is this becomes Craigslist for all the wrong reasons.
Yes.
And the opportunity is this becomes the way spiky freelancers who are a little bit exceptional get to monetize at a level that they really frankly deserve. And I'm thinking about all of the people that inspire me on a day-to-day basis that I see, and I'm just, Ayo's just one example that was top of mind, but you know, I think about a Julie Verhage. I think about so many people that just come top of mind. Koki Hastosis. Like, who are these people out there where I'm like, I just want you to get more money, and if you did that thing around it, you know? So two things at once.
Yeah, that's how I feel too, and I would just add one additional thought, which is that it kind of reminds me a little bit of the trend of financialization, right? So like in the 1980s, the financial services industry starts to sort of grow beyond just facilitating economic activity, right? And so you have all these complex financial instruments and like all these extra layers of financial intermediation that kind of sneak in the middle. And at a certain point, financial services, you sort of wake up and it's like a third of the economy. And you're like, well, how did that happen? And it's because, you know, the like sort of focus on it as a discipline disconnected from anything else sort of takes on a life of its own. And it's amazing how in capitalist systems, you can sort of manufacture economic value, even though actually no like economic value is being created. And I kind of see this as like the entrepreneurship equivalent to that, right? Because like when I look at this kind of stuff, it's entrepreneurship without any actual products being built at all. And to a certain degree, I think that is kind of a scam or something that could very easily fall into like, yeah, Craigslist for all the wrong reasons, as you said. But I'm also cognizant of the fact that, you know, the way the stock market works today is very similar, right? Like most stock trading has very little to do with the fundamental analysis of cash flows of companies and a desire to get a good dividend over a long period of time. That doesn't really describe the stock market anymore, but someone in the 1960s would look at Robinhood and would be like, I don't understand this. This doesn't make any sense to me. And so I am cognizant of the fact that the internet economy in a very pure sort of financialization sense might end up having economic opportunities attached to it that aren't really grounded in reality. And as a millennial or as someone who didn't grow up in that like environment natively, I find that kind of strange, but I also don't know that that necessarily means it's wrong. So that's another point of tension I have with this.
Just to counterpoint that, though, because I think it's worth playing both sides.
Yeah.
How many people would pay for the 10-part series of everything Alex Johnson learned about fintech in his last 20 years? You know,
it's
like
a good question.
The frameworks you use, the way you think about the market.
That's a very good question. I'm sort of terrified to know the actual answer to that, but
right. But then it would just sit there. Like, you don't need Alex to actually be
there.
Right. It just sits there, and people early in their career onboarding, joining a fintech company for the first time can take the Alex Johnson 0 to 1 sort of course on fintech. And that, I imagine, would have massive, massive value. And it's earning you money for something you've already done. You don't have to create something new all the time. So that is a product that has value, that is digital, that could exist on a marketplace like this.
100%. And I think that the success ultimately of this platform will be, can they tip themselves more in that direction and away from the Ponzi schemes? And that's going to be the question. And so I watched them with interest. Mr. Taylor, your second company, please.
Okay. Because people like difficult to pronounce words, my second company is called Revenue, as in Reva, N-E-W. Get it?
Oh, I do. Okay.
So this is the payments operations platform that helps marketplaces and platforms. So again, think like a WALP, think about eBay, Etsy as a marketplace, think about a SaaS platform that's embedding finance. It helps them manage multiple payment service providers, complex payment flows, reconciliation. But here's why it's different to everybody else doing payment orchestration. It also provides a clear dashboard of unit economics. So there comes a time in every company's life when it scales to needing multiple PSPs. You know, like classic story I hear, I'm sure you hear it a lot. We were on Stripe and now we've added somewhere else because we've gone into another market or we wanted redundancy. Now I need to build a ledger. That's where all the payments automation companies have done quite well. Could be for expansion or cost or reconciliation or just to avoid lock-in with a single PSP. But the problem is unit economics become almost impossible to calculate and trace. So Revenue has focused on giving you that complete dashboard and that complete breakdown so that you can actually run the business as if you were a payments expert pulling this thing apart. So it's a very different way of looking at payments automation and orchestration, because that was a crowded category. When I first saw this, I was like, oh, great, just another. And then I was like, oh, wait. In the age of cost control, especially in fintech, this is well-timed. Now, will every other orchestration platform have this feature tomorrow? Possibly. But getting to the bottom of unit economics is a lot harder and a lot more nuanced than first meets the eye.
Oh, yeah.
Because I have a payment in, a payment out, a ledger operation. I have a refund risk. I have errors. Oh my goodness. So what are all of those underlying costs? What are those cost drivers? Is this actually making me any money over the longer term? How do I make decisions about what markets I should enter? How do I make strategic decisions about where I should go next? This just struck me as like one of those things that could be way too niche, or it could be brilliant. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's fascinating. I am exactly where you are in terms of when you see these crowded categories and you see one more, the immediate question that springs to mind is like, okay, like what's the plan here? You know, and so the use any PSP, like we're not going to try to get too deep on that side or force you to use us. Like that immediately is, okay, now I get it. Like now I understand how, if you're going to go to someone else and say, you know, hey, we want to take on this job to be done for you. Like, okay, well, what do I get out of doing that? Well, first is you don't have to change those kind of core components. We give you that optionality. That's great. And then to your point about the kind of knowing your margin stuff and the unit economics, that one is, as you say, really well-timed. And it kind of fits into this broader trend that I'm seeing in the space where, as you said, payments orchestration is relatively crowded, but payments orchestration is, I guess, another way into the same sort of core impulse that's driving companies these days that has motivated them to invest in expense management and spend management, has motivated them to invest in, have you seen sort of the explosion recently of like cloud cost automation and that sort of operational discipline around maintaining your cloud and IT spend costs? So like there's all of these, I guess, different ways in of attacking this problem of at a certain point as a company, you just sort of have a really hard time understanding exactly like what your margins are, where your costs are, what your unit economics are. And it feels sort of like, again, speaking of being an old millennial, this is an old reference and maybe a really US reference, but did you ever have those, the how many licks to get to a center of a Tootsie Pop commercials? Do you remember those? from a million years ago?
No, but I can sort of infer from the title what the dealio is.
They're burned into my mind as like a 9-year-old. I'll just never be able to unsee it. But basically, Tootsie Pop, Lollipop, they had like a kind of candy center. And the question was, how many licks does it take to get to the center of a Tootsie Pop? And it kind of reminds me a little bit
of Alex was there dutifully counting every single
one. Don't think that was untrue. I was absolutely doing that. And it's kind of this like interesting question of the center problem is, how do you get a really defined and sort of comprehensive view of your costs and your business? And it feels like everyone is burrowing to that center from different places. And this is the first one of these that I've seen that seems to be trying to get there from a payments and payment orchestration and reconciliation perspective. And I actually think that might be an interesting way to go, because obviously payments, reconciliation, like dealing with payment flows, like collecting funds, that is a very sort of central place where a lot of those insights would be generated. So I could see that being a good on-ramp to getting to that kind of center point problem that seems to be motivating a lot of companies right now.
No, completely. The timing here is really, really good. They have an image on their homepage that suggests, you know, this foreign exchange transaction, you know, somebody was buying in one currency, you're in another currency. When you take out all of the FX risk, when you take out the conversion, when you take out the fees going to all of the different parties, ended up with a 3.64% margin. That was the precise answer to that question. It feels like tech generally, since interest rates have risen, but also since the sort of correction of the silliness of 2021, is getting leaner and meaner. And the winners are those that are winning in the cost battleground. And what's crazy, I looked at the Nubank results.
Oh, yeah.
That came up. And, you know, they just delivered $1 billion of profit and a 26% return on equity. Their cost of acquisition per customer is around $5. Their average revenue per user is about $26. That's not a lot. And they've only just started to turn on cross-selling with 100 million customers. Now, Brazil is a bit of a cheat code. Itaú Unibanco, the largest bank there, has a similar return on equity and has been doing incredibly well in the mass affluent sector and the prime sector. But at this rate, Nubank will be the most profitable bank in the world in about 12 to 18 months. Now, look at what's happening with Monzo in the UK, with Starling. They're all delivering this incredible cost performance. And this next sort of 5 years in mature sectors of fintech are all about economies of scale and who can deliver on that opportunity. These smaller pieces like it that enable it will do well. But I think the bigger picture is an important one, which is we're in the battle for lean, mean cost management machines. That's a terrible title. But you
title for the episode. I love it. No, I think that's exactly right. And I mean, it does just touch on one last thing, which is that the market for the time being, and everything is cyclical, but for the time being, is really done valuing like tech companies as an example based on like future expectations, right? Like, I mean, we've seen this over and over and over again that you have to, if you want to be rewarded in public markets in particular, you have to be able to demonstrate that exact type of detailed financial profile that you just described. And it doesn't matter what your kind of core business is, they need to be able to see that the numbers make sense. And so, yeah, I think that that pressure is going to reverberate through the entire tech stack that all these companies use. And the core question that's going to justify your place in that stack is going to be, do you help me get a handle on this so that we can start moving these numbers in the right direction?
100%. It's time to manifest, my friend.
Well, no, can I do one more real quick?
Oh, look at that. That's the tiredness.
Yes. Simon's trying to cut me off on my last question. I'll go fast. And this is actually one that you know, I think, pretty well, so we can be efficient on it. But you know Nia One, right?
Yeah, know them well.
Yes.
They've been around for some time.
They have. And yet they appear on my shores, Simon Taylor, relatively recently. I know they sort of come from across the pond, but I think it is an interesting company to talk about just in the context of the moment that we're in. And you were at FinTech Meetup, so you were hearing these conversations, I'm sure, like nonstop. But the conversation in the industry right now is, how do banks and fintech companies work together? And like, what does that look like? And what is the path forward for that? And obviously, I'm referring to banking as a service, but I think more broadly, the question that I see from a lot of banks is, and I'll just take this from the bank side, we can't compete without fintech. Like, we're not one of these large sort of well-run banks that's able to kind of innovate and sort of stay on the edge by ourselves. We're one of the other, you know, 3,500, you know, or
not so well.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, we're one of the thousands of other ones, those guys. Not bad banks, but just like that, we can't keep pace with this. We need fintech to compete. And for a while, I think the dominant methodology or sort of philosophy around how you compete as a smaller bank through the leveraging of fintech is to do banking as a service. And obviously, banking as a service has had its own set of problems. I think we're going to find our way through those problems. But I also think that that kind of became a bit of a lazy answer for a lot of banks, because on the one hand, like partnering with fintech companies, like partnering, like working together to launch new products or finding joint customer opportunities or finding fintech partners that could generate new products or new services or, you know, new loans for your portfolio that you could buy. Like, that was really hard, sticky, unpleasant work that required a great deal of sort of focus. Or, you know, during the halcyon days of banking as a service, I could just flip on banking as a service, bring on a bunch of partners, and the revenue would just roll in. And I didn't really have to deal with kind of the front end of those partnerships. That, I think, is what's getting kind of washed out with this latest sort of pressure on banking as a service. And I think where it leaves banks is kind of back at a starting place of going, okay, we still need to work with fintech companies because they're sort of the growth driver, right? To reference Nubank, like that's what's driving growth and activity and engagement in the marketplace. But banking as a service might not be the right sail to catch that wind with. It is for some, but you have to have really strong compliance and all these other things that we spent a lot of time talking about. Or alternatively, is there a different model where I can leverage these fintech companies in a different way? And I think that Nya One with their, I think they call it a sandbox as a service, which is sort of an interesting branding. Their approach is to basically provide sort of a, as I understand it, kind of well-vetted out marketplace or sandbox of fintech partners that banks could leverage that would sort of cut through a lot of the work that goes into finding partners, the procurement and sort of onboarding processes, the challenges of integrating with them, managing security and compliance and all of those other risks. Like, if you can knock down a lot of those barriers, not reduce them to zero, obviously, but if you can lower them, then maybe partnering with fintech in other models besides banking as a service becomes more feasible. And actually, it's interesting. It kind of reminds me of what credit unions have been doing for a long time, because credit unions haven't really played in the banking as a service space as much. But through their credit union servicing organizations, they have started doing a lot more kind of vetted partnership work. And I wonder if this is kind of the equivalent of that on the bank side. So Simon, give me your quick take on these guys.
Yeah. So I love that perspective, first off, of like, the answer's banking as a service. What's the question? Fintech partnerships equals banking as a service is not the case at all. Like, look at what Gusto has done with JP Morgan, for instance, where they're offering payroll to merchants as a partnership. That's not banking as a service. I look at what's happened with Navan and Citibank, where they're offering expense management and travel capabilities, like an Amex-like capability, as a partnership. Those are big banks doing it, but like, partnerships doesn't have to mean banking as a service for it to be accretive. There's like a whole universe of potential, and it doesn't have to mean revenue generating. It could mean cost takeout. So there's a whole bunch of things that you're doing internally today where infrastructure companies from fintech could be helping you do it better, faster, cheaper than your existing process or manual workflow or whatever else. Why wouldn't you want that? So first off, love that point. Secondly, Nya One, a little bit different. So I think the folks like Synctera would say, and even some of the BaaS providers would say, we do a similar vetting, you know, we help you get access to some of these suppliers, but they start in a different place. Because to your point, ultimately for the financial institution, for the bank, it's about acquiring the cheapest possible deposits and pushing out lending at the lowest possible acquisition cost, right? It's really a much more highly profitable activity if you do it in this fashion. I think it was you that pointed out that Bancor has exited its consent orders and just delivered 26% return on equity.
Yeah.
So banking as a service is lucrative if done right, but it's not the only answer and it might not be the answer for you. Nia One, to your point, does have this marketplace, and that's what it looks like to the bank, because like, here are all of these pre-vetted things. To the fintech, there's a different proposition, which is not only come list yourself on this marketplace, but get access to synthetic data based on, trained on, the underlying accounts of real banks that you will work with. And so they have a data set in the United Kingdom of over 30 million customers that are very representative of the population. It's been cleansed and removed of any PII. It's been synthetically altered, et cetera, et cetera. So let's say I've invented a credit underwriting widget and I think it's better than your existing underwriting model. I can test it and do a POC against that data without ever having to do any integration with you whatsoever. And you can A/B test those with your existing models into that platform. So there's an ability to really quickly see ROI there that's key. I love all of this. I love what Nia One's built. They've been around for a while, and it's very hard to see, in the UK at least, any big case studies of where it's hit any home runs. And Karen, I'm sorry, he's a great guy. He's been doing God's work for a while. But actually, I think the pivot to the US might be the right move, because the UK banking market is so concentrated. If you're going to deliver return ROI for this type of partnership, doing it with the four big banks who can make money just by standing still doesn't make sense. It's that or Monzo and Starling, who could probably build it themselves or would partner with you when you're small. So Nia One doesn't add value really in either of those cases that much. They do add value, but not in as much. The smaller financial institution, that just might be the sweet spot here. That just might be the place to go. I do think there's an opportunity above that for folks like True North to partner here, those integration partners who are very good at handholding the smaller financial institutions around some of this stuff. Even the Thought Machines of the world who, you know, as the side core, the alternative core, the rip and replace core, has signed a deal with JP Morgan, but is working with Arvorest Bank and lots of other smaller financial institutions that are finally taking the leap and saying, you know what, I don't want to be a prisoner to my core provider anymore, but I'm also not going to go build it myself. I need something different. So this could be a part of that patchwork. I really do think the move to the US is sensible for these guys. But I also just want to leave you with one final thought, which is all the tech in the world won't solve a culture knowledge issue. Like, unless the financial institution is willing to partner and willing to learn, then it's all for zero. My observation of FinTech Meetup, though, is I've never seen more willingness.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. And I think that, you know, kind of goes back to my CUSO comparison in credit union land, because one of the things that the CUSOs have been doing really well the last couple of years is not only do they do the work of integrating with these fintech companies, vetting them, in a lot of cases, actually investing in them, they actually spend a lot of time bringing credit unions and fintech companies together and spending a lot of time together. And I think that is, to your point, Simon, a really key part of this. And so as much as, yeah, I'm sure Nia One's technology is great, and the synthetic identity point that you made is a really good one in terms of ways they can kind of make it easier to get started, I think a big part of their success or failure will be how much they're able to foster a community between that segment of banks that you described and fintech companies that want to work with them. Because there is, I mean, even with the level of like enthusiasm that I think there is around partnerships still, I was looking at data from our friend Ron Shevlin's What's Going On in Banking report. And one of the things they always ask about in that report is, of community bankers, how big a priority is partnering with fintech companies? And it dipped down a bit for the first time in several years. And I don't think that necessarily is indicative of the fact that they don't want a partner or don't view that as a valuable activity. But I think it does sort of indicate a certain world weariness. And part of that's related to Bass and everything that's going on there. But I think just more generally, people who've kind of dipped their toes in this, it's really hard. And it's hard, to your point, not just from a technology perspective, but from a culture perspective. So I agree with the opportunity. I think the US is by far the best market to try this model in. The UK, Canada, these really like concentrated banking markets, like no chance that it's going to really work there. But I do think the US, the timing and just the structure of the market might make for a really good opportunity. And it's just, you know, as with a lot of these things, a question of execution.
It is. I really wish them well.
Me too.
Because the world needs what they do.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, Mr. Taylor, now that I've gotten my last company off my chest, let's manifest some things real quickly. I will give you the opportunity to go first.
All right. So I wrote recently about Moody's.
You super did, yes.
Super interesting business. Just from listening to a podcast about them, the Business Breakdowns one, really, really kind of got the juices flowing. And one of the things they've done extremely well is build this moat around data for business risk. Very, very good at business risk. But who's doing that for the next decade, the next two decades? Who's building the Moody's for fintech? Who's building the cash flow underwriting equivalent, but for business? We've seen, you know, Prism data, we've seen cash flow underwriting, we've seen payroll data as a source. We haven't really seen the alternative underwriting startups get traction at scale. I know there's a few of you out there, but we haven't seen one that gets traction at scale. And I think that is something that everybody who's decided lending to businesses is suddenly a great idea because interest rates have gone up in B2B fintech is sort of building themselves. They're all, you know, if you think about what revenue-based finance is, it's kind of an alternative data set for underwriting. And there's a lot of these things kind of cropping up, but there isn't like a language for them, like AAA or AAB, or nobody really knows what that means. And once you can package it with one of those ratings, you can resell it, you can create a secondary market around it. It's much more easier to build a securitization desk. So yeah, maybe the answer here is Moody's. You know, maybe Moody's is building the Moody's of the next decade because they're an incredibly innovative company. They are acquisitive as all heck. But yeah, that was my manifesting.
I like that. I think that's a great one. I read your article, loved it. I thought it was incredible. I always like when you look at like 115-year-old company, it's like, actually, they're really innovative and they're doing all these great things. You probably just don't think about them this way. And I guess the thing I would add to that is on the business side for kind of this new emerging set of companies, it seems like it's starting more in the realm of identity than it is like kind of credit worthiness or risk. And I find that to be really interesting because I see a lot of startups kind of playing in like the B2B identity space. And I think they could take a leaf out of Moody's book, to your point, because identity might make sense as a place to start, but ultimately what you need to get to is, as you're saying, a standardized measure of risk and reputation that you can build markets off of. And Moody's understands that very well. And it kind of also reminds me of, I wrote about FICO a while ago, and they did the similar thing on the consumer side, right? Where it's like, the credit score is great, but the credit score is a mechanism for secondary market activity and securitization. And as a standard, that's what makes it bulletproof. And to your point, apart from Moody's with the sort of market that they're in today, I don't really see anyone kind of contemplating that on the B2B side right now. I see it a lot on the consumer side, but not so much on the B2B side. So that's a very interesting one. I like it. Mine is not totally dissimilar, but it's relating to buy now, pay later. I would like to manifest a buy now, pay later, or if you prefer more broadly, an embedded lending bureau. And the reason that I want that is that I believe very strongly that in order for the lending ecosystem to function well, lenders need to share their data. And The buy now, pay later companies, with a couple of exceptions, have been very unwilling to share their data with the credit bureaus.
Oh.
Apple did just recently announce that they were going to be furnishing their buy now, pay later data to Experian. So there's one. Sezzle, I think, does as well. For a long time, Affirm for their longer point of sale loans has been furnishing data. But if you get into like the really big Afterpay, Klarna, Affirm, Pay in 4 products, those don't furnish data anywhere. And despite the credit bureau's best efforts to get them to over the last couple of years, they still don't. And not only do they not do that, but they don't even really open up their data to be accessible via open banking if consumers want to share the data associated with it. So they keep the data to themselves. And part of the concern, I think, on the part of the buy now, pay later providers is we don't really trust the credit bureaus to get this right. Like, if we give them their data, we think that it's going to get integrated into the credit file wrong. We don't think they really understand the structure of our product. We're concerned that if they integrate it in a bad way, it's going to tank all of our customers' credit scores, which goes against the value proposition that we're trying to offer our customers. And so there's like a level of distrust that they just don't think the bureaus can handle it well. Fine. I don't have a problem with that. Like, that's totally fine to me. I could understand feeling that way. However, I don't think that lets you off the hook for having to find a different way to share your data. So what I would want to manifest is, and I think this has been discussed behind closed doors a little bit, why don't you all get together and start your own bureau? And you can all structure it exactly the way that you want to. It can be based around the unique things that make kind of embedded or point of sale lending different in your minds. You can even build attributes and credit scores on top of it and help lenders figure out the best way to use the data. You can expand it beyond buy now, pay later into other forms of embedded lending or retail credit. But don't just, you know, say no. Offer us an alternative. That's what I would manifest.
Here, here. You know, as you were listing out all of their objections, I was like, those are meaningful objections. Like, and I was going to add to them as well, which is you can furnish data to a bureau, but you can't make somebody use it if they're right. using the wrong version or they're not willing to pay for yes. it. You know, like there's a whole bunch of stuff that could go wrong with it. So all valid objections. So yeah, I love the turnaround. Okay, then you guys figure it out. And industries, especially nascent industries, are terrible at collaborating on things that create a rising tide unless somebody forces them to. And that is something where, time and time again, the lesson of history is that if you put the effort in, not only do you win, the whole ecosystem wins, and they win big. Go read the Fresno drop
yeah.
and all of the history of Visa and anything by DHOC generally, just as one case study of the classic example of a rising tide. And financial institutions know this. They build market structures all the time for all kinds of things where they know they have an area that is not competitive, but fixing it at scale together as an industry will benefit us all, because rather than us all doing a half-decent job at it, why don't we have one thing that does a great job at it? Manifest away, my friend. I'm right there with you.
Okay, excellent. Well, we have manifested two really good ones. We've talked about four fascinating companies. Mr. Taylor, thank you as always for your time and brilliance, and maybe we'll see you again next month.
Thank you for having me. I'm now going to go manifest some sleep and be ready to do this again.
All right. Good man. We look forward to it. We'll see you down the road.
Stay classy.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FinTech Takes. Stay up to date with emerging companies and the latest FinTech trends by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. And if you love FinTech Takes, please tell a friend.